This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We've begun an archaeological dig in Jerusalem, just south of the Temple Mount. This type of activity is the target of a new report from European Union diplomats who say that Israel is using these excavations, quote, as a political tool to modify the historical narrative and to support, legitimize, and expand settlements. That's quite a statement. It's quite an accusation against Israel. We're going to talk with Brent Nachtigall in Jerusalem, who's working on that dig that we're a part of, about this report and some of its ramifications, what it tells us about Europe. Quite an interesting interview we'll have later in the show. We'll also talk with trumpet writer Jack Wood about anxiety building within Eastern European nations over Russian aggression. The Swedish government, for example, is passing out millions of pamphlets to its citizens on how to survive war with Russia. So this is a really prophetically relevant subject for us to look at. We're going to start, though, with a couple of news items. You know the self-checkout lanes that are cropping up in more and more grocery stores. You might not have realized this, but apparently there is a whole lot of shoplifting going on thanks to these self-checkout lanes. A 2015 study from the University of Leicester audited 1 million self-checkout transactions over a full year. And they found that out of $21 million in sales, almost $850,000 worth of goods left the store without being scanned and paid for. In a recent survey by an internet coupon company, nearly one in five people admitted to having stolen in a self-checkout lane. These facts come from an article in The Atlantic with this headline, "The Banana Trick and Other Acts of Self-Checkout Thievery." This is pretty stunning to me. I think it's a good sign of just the climate of lawlessness in today's society. Let me read a couple of quotes from this article. "Self-checkout theft has become so widespread that a whole lingo has sprung up to describe its tactics. Ringing up a T-bone at $13.99 a pound with a code for a cheap 49-cent a pound variety of produce is called the banana trick. If a can of Illy espresso leaves the conveyor belt without being scanned, that's called the pass around. The switcheroo is more labor intensive. Peel the sticker off something inexpensive and place it over the barcode of something pricey. Just make sure both items are about the same weight to avoid triggering that pesky unexpected item alert in the bagging area." So folks are getting pretty good at gaming the system. Some people are looking at what's happening here, and they're basically saying, well, of course people are going to steal when you don't have checkers at the front of the store. This article says the Leicester researchers concluded that the ease of theft is likely inspiring people who might not otherwise steal to do so. Rather than walk into a store intending to take something, a shopper might, at the end of a trip, decide that a discount is in order. It quotes one retail employee telling the researchers, "People who traditionally don't intend to steal might realize that when I buy 20, I can get 5 for free." The authors further propose that retailers bore some blame for the problem. This is amazing. They say the retailers bear some blame for the problem in their zeal to cut labor costs. The study said supermarkets could be seen as having created a crime-generating environment that promotes profit above social responsibility. A crime-generating environment. People cannot be trusted. If they have the opportunity to steal, they'll do it. This article cites a comment on a Reddit discussion board. It says, "Anyone who pays for more than half of their stuff in self-checkout is a total moron. There is no moral issue with stealing from a store that forces you to use self-checkout, period. They are charging you to work at their store." They're charging you to work at their store. Doesn't that make perfect sense? This is what happens, ladies and gentlemen, when you exalt moral relativism. People can just make up their own rules. They feel perfectly justified. They feel entitled to take what they want. It's their right. After all, in their mind, they're working for the store, technically. So it's just, this is like part of their wages for patronizing that store and doing the work of what should be done by a checkout individual. That is basically the same mentality of the people who loot from stores whenever they feel they can, because the stores are owned by rich people and they're just taking advantage of poor people. It's kind of a natural extension of the mindset that is engendered by government handouts, that you're not responsible for providing for yourself, and you have some adversarial viewpoint toward entrepreneurs and people who make businesses work. I think this is a really good specific example of why America's founders said that the system that they established would only work for a moral people. If you're going to have this much freedom, then you need to govern yourself according to absolute moral standards of conduct. I'm reminded of George Washington in his famous farewell address when he said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." You have to have religion, you have to have morality if you're going to be able to function within a free society and have political prosperity. French political scientist Alexis de Tocqueville, he came into America in 1831, and he couldn't believe how much freedom Americans have, but he also saw that religion was critical to making that possible. He said, "Liberty regards religion as its companion in all its battles and its triumphs. It considers religion as the safeguard of morality, and morality as the best security of law and the surest pledge of the duration of freedom." That's a beautiful thing to set your mind on if you think about it, that morality secures freedom. The reality is, once you lose your religion, you lose morality, and ultimately that means you lose freedom as well. And the amoral environment that's spreading in America today, it's costing us more and more of our freedoms. I mean, this is a pretty small example in one sense, but it really is emblematic of a problem that is facing us on a broad scale in this country. Here's another item, and this will give you an idea of what I'm talking about, maybe in a little different way. If you want to know just how ideologically perverse America's educational system is becoming, how much worse it's going to get, you don't have to look far. There are schools that are on the vanguard of a movement to stop teaching our children things like reading and writing and math and history, or certainly prioritizing those types of subjects, so that they can teach them subjects like racial equity. They're turning school into a liberal propaganda machine. This is a Weekly Standard article with the title, "Inside a Public School Social Justice Factory." In 2013, this is almost 5 years ago, public school system in Edina, Minnesota, adopted a strategic plan that was called All for All. And it says that this plan reordered the district's mission from academic excellence for all students to racial equity. So this is one of the top school districts in the state of Minnesota. It's in an upscale suburb of Minneapolis. So what did this plan call for? All for All. The Edina School District's All for All plan mandated that henceforth, quote, all teaching and learning experiences would be viewed through the, quote, lens of racial equity, unquote, and that only racially conscious teachers and administrators should be hired. District leaders assured parents that this would reduce Edina's racial achievement gap, which they attributed to barriers rooted in racial constructs and cultural misunderstandings. So it's a program that is ostensibly aimed at helping minority students, eliminating this racial achievement gap. The article continues, as a result, the high school or the school system's obsession with white privilege now begins in kindergarten. At Adina's Highlands Elementary School, for example, K through 2 students participated in the Melanin Project. The children trace their hands, color them to reflect their skin tone, and place the cutouts on a poster reading, "Stop thinking your skin color is better than anyone else's. Everyone is special." Highlands Elementary's new racially conscious elementary school principal runs a blog after the school's for the school's community. On it, she approvingly posted pictures of Black Lives Matter propaganda and rainbow gay pride flags, along with a picture of protesters holding a banner proclaiming gay marriage is our right. On a more age-appropriate post, she recommended an ABC book for small children titled A is for Activist. Peruse the book and you find all sorts of solid gold. F is for feminist. C is for creative counter to corporate vultures. And T is for trans. This is what they're teaching kids at Highlands Elementary. At Adina High School, the equity agenda is the leading edge of a full-scale ideological re-education campaign. A course description of an 11th grade U.S. literature and composition course puts it this way. By the end of the year, you will have learned how to apply Marxist, feminist, post-colonial, and psychoanalytical lenses to literature. The primary vehicle in the indoctrination effort is a year-long English course required of all 10th graders that centers not on reading literature and enhancing writing skills, but on the politicized themes of colonization, immigration, and social constructions of race, class, and gender. So they are creating the social paradise of fairness that more and more educators are pining for, that is becoming the mainstream view. This is what you're hearing more and more from media, from politicians, from business leaders, as our society becomes more and more politicized. And they're promoting these concepts of fairness and tolerance. And it really is exactly the opposite in terms of what they actually tolerate. When you look at what's actually happening here, in order to force people to buy into some of, well, what really is like a new orthodoxy, you have to think this way or else you're going to be punished. As soon as you start prioritizing that kind of thought policing, then you end up having to take some pretty strong measures in order to ensure that you accomplish your purposes. Here are another couple of paragraphs from this. One, it talks about a mandatory session for school bus drivers. And how there was a 25-page instructional curriculum that explained how these bus drivers were meant to think. The training session was titled Adina School District Equity and Racial Justice Training, Moving from a Diversity to a Social Justice Lens. This is for bus drivers. In it, trainers instructed bus drivers that, quote, dismantling white privilege is the core of our work as white folks, and that working for the Adina schools requires, quote, a major paradigm shift in the thinking of white people. Drivers were exhorted to confess their racial guilt and embrace the district's equity ideology. Now, this is a great example of what I was just talking about with freedom. You see this really in every case where you have people implementing this type of thinking, that they use coercion, they use extremely and progressively authoritarian measures to make these things happen. And in this case, in this article, it even quotes a man named Orlando Flores and how he and his wife pulled their son out of the school. He was an academic superstar, pulled him out of the high school in his senior year in order to escape its hyper-political environment. The article says Flores fled a Marxist regime in Nicaragua as a child, and he said this, "Years ago, we fled communism to escape indoctrination, absolutist thinking, and restrictions on our freedom of speech. If we see these traits in our schools in America, we must speak out and oppose it." So this guy recognizes it for exactly what it is. This is the same kind of indoctrination and absolutist thinking that he ran away from in Nicaragua as a young man. Now, how is this all-for-all policy affecting the students academically? After all, this is all this racially inclusive instruction. This really should help these racial minorities in these schools, shouldn't it? Well, 4 years into the Adena School's equity crusade, there's been a single positive point of data. Black students' reading scores, all grades, all ages, have slightly increased from 45.5% proficiency in 2014 to 46.4% proficiency in 2017. Not quite 1% increase in proficiency reading scores. Other than that, the news is all bad. Black students, quote, on track for success in reading, decreased from 48.1% in 2014 to 44.9% in 2017. Math scores decreased from 49.6% proficiency to 47.4%. Black students on track for success in math decreased from 51% to 44.7%. The drop was most notable at the high school level. Math scores for black students in the 11th grade in Adena Senior High dropped from 31% proficiency in 2014 to 14.6% in 2017. Math scores. In reading, scores for black students in 10th grade dropped from 51% proficiency to 40% proficiency. So they're hurting these students academically. This is the education of the future in America. The priority isn't on developing academic skills. It's not on strong literacy or strong numeracy. It's not on good study habits or a hard work ethic. It's on filling students' mind with these misguided ideals that end up harming the people they are supposedly intended to help. And if only our educators would honestly look at the results of these kind of experiments and then stop them when they're proven to be failures. But they never do that. They never look at the actual fruits of this kind of misinformed experimentation with our children or in any other arena where they're doing these types of things. I've written an article. It's up on thetrumpet.com right now. I'd encourage you to go check it out. It's called The New American Morality. And it talks about how we've thrown out the absolute moral code of the Bible. We've replaced it with a shifting and changing and confusing new morality. Yet quite suddenly, everyone is expected to abide by these new rules. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul warned against people who, like we see happening on a broad scale, they're ignorant of God's righteousness and they're going about to establish their own righteousness, and they haven't submitted themselves to the righteousness of God. And that's exactly what's happening here, and the fruits are terrible. We also have a trend article. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Moral Decline in Britain and America. And the quip under that title, the consequences of discarding a sacred moral code to govern the actions of individuals are far graver than most people realize. It really shows how this trend is hastening America's collapse. This isn't just a matter of something happening on the fringes of society. This is an issue that will determine the survival of society.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
There's been a lot of tremendous archaeological work in Israel to prove the biblical history in that area, and particularly in Jerusalem. The Trumpet has been able to participate in several phases of Jerusalem archaeology, uncovering some very exciting history. But this type of activity is actually the target of a new report from European Union diplomats who say that Israel is using these excavations, quote, as a political tool to modify the historical narrative and to support, legitimize, and expand settlements. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer and archaeologist Brent Nachtigall from Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
First of all, how are things going there? Give us the update on what's going on in the dig.
Yeah, life's going really well in the dig. I think this is our we've just begun or almost ending our third or fourth week, and a lot of the students are getting tired just because it's a hard day's work. The last couple of days here in Jerusalem have been beautiful, over 70 degrees. Here we are in the middle of winter, and we were worried for this excavation that we would be rained out and that we wouldn't be able to continue working because of the rain for many days. And yet the sun's come out, dried the ground out really nicely, so we can really start digging hard and fast. And that's what we've been doing in these two areas. We did publish a video on keytodavidcity.com. I think that was maybe on Thursday or Friday last week, maybe Friday last week or Thursday last week, which will give our listeners an idea of the two areas where we're working. And we are getting down to clean archaeology without modern intrusions, which is what you tend to have at the beginning of an excavation as the ground lay open for number of years before you go back to dig. And so we're getting through those layers and progressing downwards, both in a cave and also inside this structure from the Byzantine period about 1500 years ago, wherein we found in back in 2012 a medallion, a golden medallion, along with a number of coins from that period, and that golden medallion having the Jewish menorah on it, and also the shofar scroll. And one other figure, it's escaping my mind right now. But that's what we're trying to uncover, more of that building, see what that building was that housed this, or that this treasure was hidden in. And so, yeah, there's not too much report as actual findings go right now, because we're so early on, but work's progressing well.
Yeah, go check that out, keytodavidcity.com. It was great to see that video and hear from Dr. Mazar. She's clearly excited to be back in action after a four-year hiatus, and it's great that we've got such a big presence there in helping her out. So tell us about this report. These EU diplomats apparently aren't too excited about what you guys and what several other groups are doing there in that area.
Yeah, this report, the EU Heads of Missions, which is, it looks to be an organization made up by EU diplomats, funded by the EU here in Jerusalem and also Ramallah, where the Palestinian Authority is headquartered. And they write an annual report at what they see to be the things in the way of peace, as they see it, some type of diplomatic solution between the Palestinians and the Israelis, two states for two peoples. That's what they want. And this year, they have chosen to really take aim at the archaeological excavations that are being taking place right in the city of David. If anyone's familiar with Jerusalem, or even slightly familiar with Jerusalem, they would have seen the big gold dome. That's on the Temple Mount. If you go about a half a mile south of that, or about a half mile south of the Temple Mount, or at least the Dome of the Rock, you'll get to an area known as the City of David, which is the ancient settlement of Jerusalem. The Gihon Spring is right there, which was the main water source for ancient Jerusalem, the main reason that the city was on this hill of the City of David. And this is where most of the excavation in Jerusalem for the past 100 years has taken place. This isn't something new. There's been digs here for a long time, basically because this is ancient Jerusalem. This is ancient Jerusalem, just south of the old city walls. And it's also, though, where before 1967, this was Jordanian territory. This was not part of West Jerusalem. This was very close to the border between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. And by very close, I mean less than a mile, less than half a mile from the border between the two, which was basically a demarcation line between the Jordanians and the Israelis. So it wasn't really a border anyway. We don't have to get into that. But nevertheless, it was in Jordanian territory. And we did have some Palestinians that lived there up to 1967, but not many. Ever since Israel took control of that area, though, this hill was mainly built up by Palestinians constructing their homes on the City of David in areas that weren't already excavated. And so we have the situation now where if you want to dig ancient Jerusalem in Jerusalem, then you have to work out how you're going to dig in this built up area of the City of David, or as the Arabs call it, Silwan.
Mm-hmm. The City of David Archaeological Park, that's right there, I guess, in the more northern part of that. The Palestinian homes are all around that area, and Jews that are coming in there to look at what's been excavated in that area, you really are right there in that Palestinian area. So the European officials are looking at this. They're actually saying they're trying, in a sense, it seems like, to delegitimize what Israel is doing here. Maybe you can just tell us, give us a little bit of an idea of what archaeology has proved in terms of the Jewish history and how the European diplomats are interpreting this or considering this some kind of threat or a problem.
Well, I think it gets down to obviously the location of this. If these excavations were taking place in West Jerusalem, we probably wouldn't have a problem. The EU wouldn't be upset by that. But what we're seeing, obviously, this is ancient Jerusalem. It's where you have to dig if you want to find ancient Jerusalem. And so the past 100 years have dug up artifacts from all different periods, not just the periods related in the Bible. Mostly, though, it's turned up remains from the Byzantine period, again, 1,500 years ago. Back further than that, into the Roman and the Herodian periods, that's when the Jews were actually here and they had a state of their own by virtue of Rome. And then you can find remains before that, going back to the biblical period. And that is the period just from walking through the city of David, excavating in the city of David. There are large remains from that period, from the time of Jeremiah and earlier. And you can even go back to the Jebusite town as well that was there. And so what you have is the EU, it seems, they're upset by the fact that there is this history that's being excavated there. They see another motive for the archaeological excavations, more than just discovering what's there and publishing it. They see it as if they were going to go there. They don't see any Palestinian. If they're going to go to the City of David for a tour, there wouldn't be any, this is a Palestinian site from 200 years ago. There was no focus on the Palestinians that are living there. And they are upset by this for some reason. It doesn't really stand up to me. If you're going to visit this site, you want to see the history, the ancient history. If that's the whole reason you're going to the City of David, you're not going there to see a modern Palestinian village. You're going there to actually look at the history from the Bible. And these aren't just Jews. In fact, there's many Jews that haven't gone here. I would encourage all Jews to go there and actually find out what's there in the ground from their own history. But a
right.
lot of them
and, and the Israeli government, they even have their soldiers go and visit that as a means of instilling with them a sense of their own national history.
Right. And those soldiers are 18, 19 years of age. And for most of them, it's the first time that they've been there, which is just astounding to me. If you knew that your heritage went back 3,000 years, why not go to the birthplace of it and see it? And it is there to see. There's too much evidence to just go through the proof of it being Jewish. I mean, you dig it, put a spade in the ground, and you dig down 4 or 5 meters, you are going to find Jewish heritage there. Or biblical heritage, Israelite heritage, you can call it what you will. I would like to just give a couple of quotes from this report, though, because it shows some of the logic of the EU, and it also shows what they're choosing to focus on, clearly, I believe, showing their bias towards the Palestinians. It says here in this report by The Guardian, who got a leaked copy of this report, they said that, I'll quote it, a leaked report acquired by The Guardian cited projects in parts of East Jerusalem, which is in the City of David here, occupied by Israel since 1967, that are being used as, quote, a political tool to modify the historical narrative and to support, legitimize, and expand settlements. So, number one, the City of David isn't a settlement. When somebody thinks of a settlement is a patch of land that you live in and you grow out of, that expands. It could be a village, like a settlement, that's Shiloh or that's Tepuach, other settlements in the West Bank, where you have a Jewish town that is constructed in the middle of the West Bank. We're talking about a village inside, just on the border in East Jerusalem. This isn't a settlement. This is mainly Palestinian territory. So I don't know what they're talking about here, that it's being a settlement.
Let me just interrupt you for a second, because we are running out of time. It seems like the language of this report, definitely there are a lot of hints. You're reading the language about settlements that kind of betray the anti-Israel orientation of these diplomats who are issuing this report. I just wonder if you if there are any other specifics where you can kind of summarize just how narrowly and biasedly they're looking at this, and what does this tell us just about Europe? And because we've been talking about just how, in light of the United States, the Palestinians saying, well, we're not going to look to the United States as a negotiating partner anymore, and there's a little more impetus being put on Europe stepping into that role. What this tells us about Europe's orientation as a potential peace partner.
Right. So just that one part of that quote that I was saying before, it says that they're trying to use this as a political tool to modify the historical narrative. That's a lie. Where archaeology doesn't modify the political narrative, the historical narrative, it shows what the historical narrative is. It proves what the historical narrative is. And the historical narrative is, read the Bible, that's the historical narrative, and dig in Jerusalem, the city of David, and you'll find the historical narrative. And they match up remarkably. Unfortunately, for the UN, it seems. One other quote says here, the site is operated by a settler organization, quote, promoting an exclusively Jewish narrative while detaching the place from its Palestinian surroundings. Again, people are going there to look at the history, and the history isn't Palestinian. If they want to detach the area from its Palestinian surroundings, I mean, the Palestinians have been there 50 years. They will tell you that. You can look at photos from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s of this area of the City of David. There's a couple of houses on it. That's it. That's it. And it's only since then that the Palestinians have got there. But people are going there to see the history. And whose fault is it that you walk around the ancient Jerusalem, the City of David, and you see Jewish history, not Palestinian? That's all there is to find. There isn't Palestinian history to find there. And to somehow say that from the EU that Israel, it almost seems like, I'm surprised they haven't said Israel is fabricating history here or making it up to try and boost an Israeli narrative, pro-Israeli narrative, because it's almost like they are kind of inferring that through what they're saying. I think it does reveal an extremely pro-Palestinian bias from the EU. And this is something we've talked about for a long time. They aren't, if we look at Bible prophecy, we expect them, the EU, to be involved in the peace process going forward. And it looks like that is not going to, they're going to try and be an honest broker, but we can see through history that they have favored the Palestinians. But that's not because they like the Palestinians necessarily. They just don't want the Jews to be in East Jerusalem, and they just don't want the Jews even to be in West Jerusalem. That's what it says, the Bible prophecy says, that they're going to even push towards. But for right now, they're happy to support the Palestinian goals because it weakens Israel. And what are they taking aim at right now to try and do that? They're taking aim at Israel's history, the Jewish history right here in ancient Jerusalem.
So I'm just curious about how much stock you put in this. You know, certainly it's a measure of Europe's hostility to Israel and its historical presence in that area. How much authority does this EU Jerusalem mission have, and what might this be used to do? How closely are you going to be watching this to see how, whether it might interfere with what you're after?
Yeah, it's just this report came out after a year of attention on Jerusalem at the UN, going back to the last act of President Obama, and the UNESCO as well. These bodies that you'd expect to want to cherish ancient history, they're actually targeting archaeology. It used to be that nations targeted Israel for their military or their what they're doing in the West Bank settlements. Now it's like they're taking aim specifically at a patch of dirt where we're digging, and they're focusing on what Israel's doing archaeologically. This, I believe, is something that's going to get more attention in the future. How much pull they have to actually do something on the ground doesn't indicate they have much just yet. But there could be a groundswell of support against Israel for digging up its own history. And I think we need to see what the EU is doing in that light.
Just looking at Europe's role in Jerusalem in the future, the Bible has quite a lot to say about it. I think you skated over a couple of really major prophecies that we need to keep our eyes on. But for the listener who wants more information and to really dig into just how important a role Europe is going to play in Jerusalem in the future, where would you send them?
They can read this article entitled A Counterfeit Peacemaker. It talks about Europe's entrance into that peacemaking role, getting fully invested in Jerusalem, in Israel, in the Palestinian peace process, and then where that will lead in the end. So that was entitled A Counterfeit Peacemaker.
All right, we'll put that in the show notes. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about an EU report criticizing Israeli archaeological activity. Really fascinating, Brent. It's good to hear from you. Good to hear how things are going over there. Keep on keeping on. Keep those students busy.
We will, for sure. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
There's a lot of talk in the United States about Russia influencing our last presidential election, meddling in American politics. But in Eastern Europe, concern over Russia is far more acute. These are nations that legitimately fear invasion by Russia. In fact, some parts of Eastern Europe are being invaded by Russia, as we've talked about on many programs before. Several nations are preparing their citizens for war with Russia. To talk about this, we have here in the studio trumpet writer Jack Wood. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker. Thanks for having me.
First time on Trumpet Hour. It's good to have you. Well, let's start by talking about Sweden. What are the Swedes doing to brace for war?
Well, the Swedes at the moment are following plans that haven't been put into action since the days of the Cold War and since the days of World War II. Starting in the spring, instructions will go out to 4.7 million Swedish homes, instructing them on how to act and prepare for crisis and catastrophes, not only in peacetime, but also for different kinds of attacks on society and Sweden. These pamphlets that the Swedish government is handing out to homes will be focused on how to deal with the potential of invasion. Well, this kind of pamphlets have not been seen for last 30 to 40 years. It's a really drastic move and has a lot of people talking about the possibility of invasion.
So they're just trying to kind of brace people. Do you have any idea of what the substance of the pamphlets is? Like what kind of information they're preparing people for? And is it just a sort of broad, addressing, trying to brace the population for the possibility? Are they taking more concrete steps in order to prepare people or to arm themselves against a potential invasion?
While the exact details of the pamphlets has not been released, it has been said that the information that the Swedish government will provide will show Swedes how to take part in the defense of their country and also how to procure various essentials like food, water, and to find shelter and heat.
So they're definitely looking into the details and saying that this is certainly a possibility based on what Russia is doing elsewhere here. And we do see more war-making language coming from Vladimir Putin, certainly. We've talked about that. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what sorts of signals they're picking up from Russia that are causing them to take these kinds of measures.
Certainly, yes. As we know, in 2017, Russia conducted one of the largest military exercises it's gone through in the last few years. That was the Zapad 2017 military exercises. Upon the completion of these exercises, Vladimir Putin addressed the country's top military manufacturers. He told these state manufacturers and private manufacturers alike to prepare to be ready to increase arms production. He's noted as saying, "The economic ability to increase the production of defense products and services quickly is a vital element of military security." And he told this to senior defense officials in November 22nd of last year. He said, "All strategic and simply large companies," meaning both government-controlled and just the big companies in his country, "regardless of the type of ownership, must be able to do this." He's talking about being able to switch from commercial and economic production through to military production at the flick of a switch. He's encouraging the companies within Russia itself to be able to begin to manufacture military hardware and support a military operation at the drop of a hat.
So Russia definitely, and we've talked about this quite a bit on this program, looking at the threats in the world, positioning themselves to be able to have somewhat of a pole position in the developing world order. And they're definitely pursuing military capability, arms procurement, and so on. These Eastern European countries are looking at this and saying, you know, we've got to keep up. So you see a similar type of thing going on in these Eastern European countries, especially. We talked a little bit about Sweden. The nation probably out most on the front line of the conflict with Russia is Ukraine. Maybe you could just bring us up to speed on what Russia's been doing there, just how Ukraine is responding to these kinds of threats from Russia.
Well, as we see, as the Ukrainian government forces continue to fight back against pro-Russian troops, there is a need for their country greater than ever to have a counter to Russian-made armored vehicles. The Russians obviously have a massive military force behind their probes and attacks into both Georgia, we've seen that, and now in Ukraine. So there's been a need for increased military hardware from these smaller countries such as Ukraine, Georgia, and smaller Baltic countries such as Latvia and Lithuania. And all of these countries here are increasing their military spending and especially purchasing anti-tank weaponry. There's a large purchasing of the FGM-148 Javelin, one of the premier portable anti-tank missile systems in the world. Now, they're purchasing them from the United States, and while some people are looking to this purchase as a sign that perhaps the United States is becoming more involved in the protection of its NATO members, this is actually not the truth, because we don't see the US taking any permanent or lasting steps to defend their allies in the region. While they may be comfortable selling these weapons to their allies, there is real no promises and no guarantee of safety. We saw that when Russia basically swooped in without firing a shot, took Crimea. Nothing happened on the world scene. The US and Britain and other NATO allies did really nothing to stop the takeover there. This has Ukraine worried. And so they're purchasing from the US and from other sources all these military weapons to be able to counter the massive Russian military might, including these FGM-148 Javelin anti-tank missile systems.
So how widespread is that? You've got Ukraine trying to beef up its support, other nations that are in the neighborhood, Belarus, Georgia, these nations are also in the market for arms that are going to prepare them to defend themselves against Russian aggression as well.
Well, analyst John Doherty from the Forward Observer, he reports that military spending will reach worldwide military spending will reach $1.67 trillion this coming year. And he's quoted as saying the region with the fastest growing defense expenditures, not surprisingly, is the Baltic region in Eastern Europe. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania are facing increased pressure from Russia and Moscow as they look to expand its influence westward. It's those countries, he says, that have the massive increase in their military spending, while countries like America, with their massive economy, can purchase much more equipment. It's those smaller nations that are seeing the massive growth in their military expenditure.
So we've had, this is really a subject that we've had some pretty blockbuster cover stories in the Trumpet, this tension between Russia and Europe. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury had one back in January 2004. The title on the cover was Russian Election Frightens Europe. We had a May 2014 Trumpet issue with his article, The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe. So we've talked quite a bit over the years, and Gerald Fleury's really been at the point on this, of how much Russian aggression affects Europe, and European nations are watching this very closely and responding to this. Everything that you're talking about here really does show the intensification of that trend. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what the Trumpet has been saying about this, why we're watching this so closely.
Oh, for sure, yes. Well, there are definitely many reasons to be worried about this Russian push. For a start, we've had the Russian history. During World War II, Russia was extremely violent and dangerous and saw numerous atrocities during its prolonged conflict with the Axis powers. Secondly, there's a massive stockpile of nuclear weapons left over from the Cold War. But most importantly, what the Trumpet has been bringing out recently is that Russia is in the center of a massive prophecy regarding what is known as the King of the North. Mentioned in Daniel 11, verses 44 to 45. Now, the crisis that's happening in Ukraine and really the Russian aggression that is causing so much fear in Europe is pushing all of Europe to really unite, knowing that it can no longer adequately rely upon its NATO allies such as US and Britain. And so it's currently pushing these nations of Europe to band together and look after themselves and kind of unite in the face of a common enemy.
Those articles from Gerald Fleury, they were just talking about how much the threat from Russia is going to be a major catalyzing influence in uniting Europe. And that prophecy that you mentioned there in Daniel 11, it talks about these tidings from the east that provoke the King of the North into taking action. And so many of these prophecies that we're talking about, it's major major warfare, taking engulfing continents. There are so many of these prophecies that talk about a European power and this Eastern power in particular clashing in some of the biggest global war that we've ever seen. Why don't you just talk a little bit about how what we're seeing today is preparing us for that, or why we really need to keep those prophecies in mind as we're watching this tension increasing, say, within Eastern Europe?
Well, certainly there is a great cause to be concerned. Going back to the pamphlets heading out, being handed out in Sweden there, they have great history in that area. There is a great history in that area regarding Russian aggression. Throughout World War II, Russia was definitely swarming through those Baltic and Scandinavian countries to counter, obviously, the Axis powers. But they were definitely there was definitely a lot of atrocities on both sides of that conflict in that region. And that region itself is just known for being soaked in the blood of countless soldiers and countless armies that have fought upon that ground. We're talking about the northeastern Europe and the border between Asia and Europe. Countless lives have been lost and wars have been fought upon that ground. So there's definitely historical reason and historical impetus for Europe to be very nervous about any aggression that is coming out from the northeast there. And certainly we really need to be watching this part of the world and watching this particular conflict because of Bible prophecy. Like I mentioned in Daniel 11, the last part of that chapter there is prophecy, and God does warn about this action that we see happening right now. Talking of the King of the North, this united Europe, the Bible prophesies in Daniel 11:40, it says, "But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him." If you're looking at the east and north of Europe, that's directly lining up with Russia. This is God directly warning the world about a conflict between Europe and Russia. And it says that the King of the North, or United Europe, will unite, and says, "Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and to utterly make away many." The wording in this scripture is incredibly powerful. This is just God really emphasizing the danger and the horror of such a conflict that may occur if Russia continues to be aggressive and Europe continues to unite and arm themselves to face them.
I appreciate that, Jack. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Jack Wood. He's written an article, it's up on the Trumpet site right now, about Sweden instructing its civilians on how to prepare for total war. And we, like I mentioned before, it really is worth going back and looking at these articles that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote, the one from January 2004, the other from May 2014, just talking about how much Russian aggression is going to have a major catalyzing influence and effect in Europe in uniting and, like this prophecy that Jack was just describing there in Daniel, these tidings out of the East really affecting this European power. So those are very, very important pillar articles that that Gerald Flory wrote. It's good to go back and review those. We really appreciate your time, Jack. Really important subject to keep our eyes on.
Thank you for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Some years ago, I spent a day at an elementary school as part of a program that invites students' fathers to be on campus throughout the day, serving as an extra pair of eyes, scoping the halls for potential threats, an extra set of hands helping in the classrooms. In 6 hours, I got an amazing education in human nature. I witnessed some pretty impressive things in some classrooms. One teacher in particular had her fourth graders breaking down sentences grammatically with jaw-dropping precision. In other classrooms, however, far less learning was going on. As teachers instructed, private conversations bubbled. Virtually any distraction derailed students from the task at hand. I believe I can distill the difference between the fruitful and the unfruitful classrooms down to a single factor, the teacher's determination to confront bad behavior. Put a bunch of kids together and you're bound to see some of that. It may start small, but if it isn't confronted and if necessary removed, it spreads. Just like the stomach virus that seems to wallop the entire elementary school every couple of months because parents ignore quarantine. It's true what the Bible says about a little leaven. A child talks while the teacher is instructing. If nothing happens, human nature whispers in the next kid's ear, huh, I guess it's okay to do that. So he talks too. Some other kid thinks, well, if he can do that, then I'll do this. In no time, the room sounds like Grand Central Station. Isn't that amazing? Sometimes I think children are hardwired to continue getting louder until someone tells them enough. The truth is, they're getting louder specifically to test how long it takes before someone tells them enough. The teacher with the intestinal fortitude to truly confront the problem can quickly transform the unruliness into ruliness. Dr. Albert Siegel once wrote, "When it comes to rearing children, every society is only 20 years away from barbarism. 20 years is all we have to accomplish the task of civilizing the infants who are born into our midst each year. These savages know nothing of our language, our culture, our religion, our values, our customs of interpersonal relations. The barbarian must be tamed if civilization is to survive." Now, that's a bit dramatic, but in a sense, it's true. Calling children savages certainly reflects reality better than treating them like natural-born saints. Our human nature represents a savage within each of us that must be civilized. Children have it in spades, unless we're diligent in confronting it. That's why Proverbs 29, verse 15 says, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings his mother to shame." Where this reality truly smacked me in the face was on the playground at this elementary school. I spent 3 recesses outside with first graders, then second graders, then fifth graders. Each successive mob was worse behaved. The fifth graders, having lived more years without being properly civilized, were genuine specimens of savagery. Everywhere I turned, I saw carnality on parade, name-calling, accusing, cursing, screaming, boasting, pushing, sulking, cheating. I realized that most of these same kids had just been inside under the authority of effective, qualified teachers who had managed to keep a lid on this ugliness. The level of human nature suddenly on display correlated precisely with the lack of government in their lives at that moment. You take a good student out of the structure of a disciplined classroom and turn him loose with 60 other kids and virtually no supervision, and you have the Lord of the Flies. I hate to admit it, but the same is true in my own house, especially when my kids were younger. Those times when my family got overly busy and I didn't give my three children enough attention, things would get louder and uglier until it was too obvious to ignore, and my wife or I stepped in with a firm enough. That's not the way family should be. Yet it may not be exaggerating to say that this form of child rearing, ignore the barbarians until they drive you mad, is the number one method used in the Western world today. There's a lot to be said for maintaining a steady presence of civilizing forces in our children's lives. Activities, instruction, reading, games, chores, crafts, charts, schedules, rewards, punishments, supervision. Kids crave structure. When it isn't there, they act out until they get it. And when they do get it, it frees them up to achieve some amazing things. Now, don't get me wrong, family isn't boot camp. It doesn't necessarily take enormous effort to steer clear of pandemonium in favor of structured or even lightly supervised play. And it's not that children shouldn't be given enough room to make mistakes. We don't want to criticize them for every word or deed that just proves they're children. We need to make sure the overall message we send is a positive one. When we do things decently and in order, the way that God does, life is happier, more rewarding, more productive, more fun. As our children grow, the responsibility for structuring their lives and bridling themselves must gradually shift onto their own shoulders. They need practice at civilizing the savage within. Otherwise, the moment they're on their own, they'll turn into big versions of the fifth graders on that playground. And if you want to know what that looks like, visit an American university. The task of civilizing the infants born into our midst is crucial. 20 years is all we have. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to my guests on the program today, Brent Noctegal and Jack Wood. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from H.L. Mencken. The urge to save humanity is almost always a false face for the urge to rule it. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.